Pastor Mai, hello and welcome to this episode of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. On this programme, we're going to reflect on a week which has turned many of our lives upside down and tested our island community. The Manx Chief Medical Director explains why flattening the curve is a must. We speak to a young person with a mild case of COVID-19 who's pleading the fit and healthy to take the virus seriously, and Gray outlined the challenges they face in helping the homeless self-isolate. It's been a tumultuous past couple of weeks with schools and borders now closed. Alfred Cannon unveiled a business package designed to keep the Manx economy afloat. Many businesses have shut down. Many people are now working from home. We've heard a lot from politicians at these press conferences in the last week, but it's vital we hear the perspective of those in the medical community during this time. Last Friday, the island's chief medical director said the health service's capacity to deal with the coronavirus pandemic is limited. Dr. Rosalind Ranson has warned the Manx NHS could be overwhelmed if faced with a steep increase in the numbers of those infected. Plans are in place to increase the number of ventilators on the island, with 6 available at present. Dr. Ranson last week told reporters it's incredibly important the public follow the advice being given.
We are limited on the island for the number of ventilators that we have. So currently there are 6, but there are already plans to try and increase that capacity. And at the moment we have a capacity of 10, but that's with making adjustments and ventilating, still using ventilation, but closing down our elective theatres, which is what we did on Friday afternoon. So there are plans to consider how are we going to meet the demand, and that obviously we're doing a huge amount of work at Nobles to meet what we, you know, the demand from the public. What we really want to emphasise is the importance of the advice, which is self-isolation, social distancing and washing your hands. It's incredibly important. We have the slight advantage of seeing what's happened across Europe and across the world, only that we can model and anticipate what we are going to encounter. So that is why we're taking it so seriously. And it's a really important message for the public, because actually it's the public that are going to influence the spread of this disease. So it's a virus that we haven't encountered before, and that's why it spreads rapidly. So that is the seriousness of this is related to our limited capacity, because we are an island, we have limited staff. So that is, it's not about necessarily buying in or getting many more ventilators, because actually you need the staff to use those ventilators. So in order to have the staff, you need to keep the staff well. And so that is why we're saying, calling upon the public of the Isle of Man to really assist us in this, because it's so important that I don't know whether the public must be aware of the steep curve and how easy it is to overwhelm a health system, which is what happened in Italy.
Dr. Rosalind Ranson, the island's chief medical director. Well, at the time of recording this programme, there were 5 cases of the virus confirmed on island, including the first person to have contracted it here. Manx resident Louise Bowker, who's 23, has contracted COVID-19 and has been self-isolating since Wednesday. She says she's feeling all right and only went from work on the advice of her employers. Otherwise, she would have continued to come in. Louisa has joined me on the programme. Louisa, how do you feel?
I mean, right now, I feel fine. I just feel like I've got a cold that hasn't existed for a couple of days. I'm not someone who ever gets run down, really. I'm not someone who always gets a fever or, you know, anything like that. But I just feel like I've got a headache. I'm a bit snotty. I've got a little bit of a sore chest. Other than that, you know, I feel fine.
So when did you first notice you were beginning to feel unwell?
So on Tuesday, just gone, I was in work and I had a headache, which I didn't think anything of, really, because I just thought maybe I hadn't drank enough water that day or I'd had too much tea and coffee. And then I woke up on Wednesday and I had, you know, quite a bad cough that did develop overnight. I'd lost my voice a little bit. I still had a headache and I felt a bit tired, but I didn't feel unwell enough to not work from home. So I carried on working as normal. It just felt like a cold, really.
At what point did you decide you'd get tested?
So it was actually my work that suggested I have a look at the online questionnaire. So that was on Friday, which I think was the day that it came out. So I did the online questionnaire, went through the steps, and obviously because I did have a cough, it recommended I call 111. I called 111, went through my symptoms, and they said, based off of what you told us, we'll send you to go and get a test, wait an hour and head down to the grandstand, because I drive, so I did put myself down there.
And how did you find going through the grandstand and the testing process? Was that all straightforward?
Yeah, it was straightforward. It looked like they were struggling a little bit because they'd only just got set up that day, so they didn't have any signs or anything at that point, but there weren't that many cars there, so they just had to, get us all into a line and, make sure that everyone got seen correctly. And they had a good process in place, which I think that their computers went down, but you wouldn't have been able to tell because they were all working. No one seemed panicked, no one seemed rushed. Everything just seemed like they'd been trained to do what they were doing.
And what is the test exactly? Is it some kind of swab or temperature check or a mixture of things?
Yeah, so all they do is they take one swab, they swab the back of your throat, and then they swab in each nostril, and then that's it.
And then after that was done, how long did you have to wait until you got your result back?
So I got my test done on Friday and it was about lunchtime, and then I got my results back on Sunday evening at 10:30. So it was 3 days, as they said, when I got the test. So when I did the test, they said it was going to be 72 hours, and that is how long it took.
And considering how scary this is for some people, how did you feel when you found out that you were positive for the virus?
I was very surprised when I found out that I had tested positive, because over the past days when I'd been isolating at home, me and my partner had been joking that I had a head cold and, we had to self-isolate because it could have been the coronavirus, and it turns out that actually it was.
With that in mind, you've sort of taken to social media to describe your experience. What advice would you give to people who, like you, may just be experiencing something as mild as a headache? What advice would you give to them, considering what ended up being your situation?
What I'd say is that just listen to what the government is saying. If my work hadn't pushed me to stay home and work from home, I felt well enough to go to work. I felt well enough to go to the shops to do my food shopping. Make sure that if you feel unwell in any way, just stay at home. Stay at home anyway, even if you aren't feeling unwell. But especially if you have any kind of cough, whether you think it could just be a cold or not, you don't know that until you've had that test. So make sure you're, preventing the spread to other vulnerable people. And just stay at home and don't socialise.
So you've been self-isolating since Wednesday, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, looking back, now knowing you've got the virus, were there any sort of trips or things you did that you're thinking, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that?
I went to work on Tuesday with the headache, and I did have a headache when I was at work, and then I went to my second job, and it was just a headache. I didn't have a cough, I didn't have a fever, so I thought none of those things are symptoms that we've been told to look out for, so I didn't think anything of it. But just doing those two things, I've come into contact with quite a lot of people. Now I'm thinking, oh, well, as soon as I had that headache, maybe I should have said to work, oh, I should have gone home, maybe I should have just said to my second job, oh, I'm just not going to come in tonight because I've got a headache and I just don't want to spread anything potentially.
Yeah, yeah. And what's the advice you've been given since you tested positive? Have you been advised to sort of get in touch with your work and colleagues to let them know of your situation and direct them maybe towards self-isolating? Or what's the message you've been given?
So I had a call from Public Health this morning, and I asked them, I said, the amount of people that I have potentially been in contact with, and said, should I be telling them to self-isolate for 2 weeks because they've come in contact with me? And they came back and said, no, as long as if they don't have any symptoms, then they don't need to self-isolate. But I am aware that that's not necessarily the advice that the Aragon government has been giving people, so it has been a bit of a mixed message there. But I've just told people anyway, just if you've been in contact with me, just self-isolate. It's just the safest thing to do.
In terms of what's in store for you now, are you just holding tight? I mean, is there any advice you've been given as somebody who has actually contracted the virus? Is there anything different you're told to do? Or is it simply paracetamol, water, staying at home kind of thing?
Yeah, they just say keep doing what I'm doing. Obviously, I haven't had a fever or anything, so I don't feel really unwell. So there's nothing that I need to do, you know, to make myself feel much better, to sort of ride out until it goes away. My partner this morning has developed a cough, so someone is coming out to us to test him, so just to see if that is what he's got. So we've just been told 2 weeks from when he's developed his symptoms to stay isolated. They said that they're going to, public health are going to call me every day just to check on how I'm doing as well.
In terms of how well you're stocked and food and the rest of it, are you both happy enough with your situation? Do you think you'll be able to, help will be available to you if you need it?
Yeah, definitely. Thankfully, you know, our electricity's on a key, which does mean that we have to go to a shop to top it up. Thankfully, we put enough money on that just before this all happened. So we feel like we're covered in that sense. We've asked, you know, friends and family to go to the shops. But obviously my family, they have been in contact with me, so they've had to go into self-isolation now. So we've had to ask other friends and family to go and do that for us, because I can't ask my mum to go to the shop for me.
Louisa Bowker. There's been a lot of focus on protecting the vulnerable during this time of crisis, with a concerted emphasis on the island's elderly residents. However, those with underlying health conditions are at both ends of our community, none more so than those who require the support of the island's homelessness charity. As of today, GRAI has closed its daily drop-in centre for the foreseeable future after advice from public health. The charity's night shelter, though, will remain open, offering a bed to those who find themselves without a place to stay. So how many people will this closure affect? Aaron Ibanez spoke to GRAI's coordinator and community worker Erica Irwin.
The stats showed that, you know, last year we had 300 different individuals come through our doors. We also support people out in the community who wouldn't normally come through the doors of GRAI anyway, but they link in with us in the wider context through telephone contact or through community support or just through the night shelter, and then we then link in with them for a little bit. I can't really give you those numbers. You know, it could be one person, it could be hundreds. We've got people who are going to be leaving their jobs. We've got people who have mental ill health but are managing with medication or through support to have managed to sustain their lives so far, but actually everything's changing, even those who don't have any anxiety or feeling anxious. So we don't know who's going to need us.
Fair enough, and it might be a similar answer then to my next question, which is basically, do you have any sort of idea or the scale of homelessness and perhaps people who have no fixed abode currently during this crisis? And I guess that raises another question. If they were to contract the virus, where would they then go to self-isolate? I mean, what's in place there?
Okay, so the first part of your question, no, would be the answer. I mean, obviously, we have a large safer surfing community here on the Isle of Man, and we just aren't aware of what those numbers are. And at the moment, up till now, it's worked where those people have managed to stay in people's houses, in their spare rooms or on their sofas. That could change, and we could find that those who are sofa surfing are no longer welcome in those homes, especially if they start showing symptoms and they have to self-isolate. How do you self-isolate if you're staying on someone's sofa? So that's, again, a situation that we've never come across before, and it may increase those who are needing the night shelter. For the second part of your question of if someone presents with symptoms and they don't know where to go, they can't isolate, obviously the night shelter is there for those who are symptom-free, and for those who need some advice, we can take telephone numbers and then we will follow up during the daytime hours. But for those who present to the night shelter with symptoms, we have a plan in place where we can isolate somebody in one of our little rooms, obviously keeping an eye and making sure they're okay and keeping ourselves safe, whilst we then contact public health or the adult generic team. We're working closely with them at the moment, had conversations with them on Friday, and we're hopefully going to get some meeting together in order to try and come up with a plan of what we do.
The coordinator and community worker for the island's homelessness charity, GRAI, Erica Irwin. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. Now, before the island was turned upside down with the coronavirus pandemic, plans to replace the cosy nook were in the headlines. A village commissioner says the facility is intended to be a major statement. The board released a mock-up image of the multi-storey eatery, which sparked a mixed reaction online, with many critical of the proposal. Nick Watterson says commissioners agreed the cosy nook had to be demolished due to the state of the old building and the cost of refurbishment. He explained to me how these bold plans came to pass.
I don't think there was any thinking we needed to make a bold statement. It was really, let's see what we can do with that facility. If we go back to how we got to where we are, the initial thinking was, well, what can we do with it? Can we keep the existing building in some format, add bits to it, or do we have to maybe start again or whatever? So the first thing we did as a commission of the commission was to make the decision about what do we do with the existing building. So what we did was we had a site visit. We looked at various reports we'd had done about the state of it. So the first vote we actually took, which I think is quite important, was do we keep it or don't we? So everything then follows from that proposition. And everyone on the board, to my recollection, after seeing the state of the property, what we could or couldn't do with it, it was a unanimous vote that we would have to level it.
But it's not like for like.
No, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
That's provoked the strongest reaction. Yeah, yeah. And I must admit, a lot of it is negative. People have said, why have they gone for something so big, so bold?
Well, I think in that graphic you've seen on online, it gives the appearance of being bold because of the angle you're looking from. You're looking from the sea straight at it. However, in reality, there is the bank behind it is curved in slightly. And I think if you're coming from Shore Road end, for example, it's going to nestle a little bit more discreetly than that might imply. So I don't think it is as big and bold as it may be suggested, but I think it's a great looking building.
So who sort of was pushing the sort of more modern design? Is that because of the requirements
no,
you've
wasn't.
Got? Or because well, some people are saying, why didn't they just have the same sort of building back
well,
in there?
Okay, so we know that we really had to rebuild. Why would you invest a lot of money rebuilding it to something that was going to only cater for the same amount of people? The amount of investment that you'd have for that and the amount you'd be able to lease the property out for probably wouldn't have made sense. So if we're going to invest money, you want to be able to make sure you can get the adequate numbers in to make it a viable proposition for someone to take on the lease. I don't think there was any possibility or realistic view that we were putting a building the same as it was. What would be the point? You're wasting all the opportunity of looking out to sea, windows, views, all the rest of it, and making sure you can make it a bigger, more modern, cleaner, accessible facility.
Well, tell us about accessible, because there's a lot of thought gone into ramps, access to the beach, access to that.
Well,
that seems to have been important to the
commissioners. Yeah, I think, that was taken into consideration. Obviously, you want to be able to have people to be able to, in a wheelchair, to be able to come along Shore Road and go straight in, regardless about bumps, steps and whatever. I think the further graphics are going to be on the website later on today. We've been a bit slow getting them drafted up to the exact spec we wanted. So, yes, there will be a ramp that will lead down from the front of the facility down onto the beach. So we looked at all sorts of ways we could make it more accessible. It's not ideal because of where it is. You know, we'd looked at possibly extending and putting in new footpath facility behind, coming down from the upper prom. However, that was just unfeasible by the length of footpath you'd have to go and obviously the sort of angle of it. We've done the best we can of making it as accessible as we can.
What is, I know you can't for commercial reasons disclose what you imagine the exact cost will be, but what's the region of the cost for this and how's it going to be funded?
It'll be funded over, like most of these investments, it'll be a capital investment. It'll be monies loaned over a period of maybe 40 years. We've got ballpark figures. It might be 600,000, it might be 700,000, it might
so
be 500,000.
It's not going over a million or anything?
Oh, like absolutely not, no. As it stands at the moment, the interest that we'd be paying on any loan is in our budget anyway. So if we went for funding next year, if plans get approved, etc., the ratepayers would notice no increase in rates.
Do you think that's important? Because you're going to have some who like the proposal and some who don't, and some might not be happy that their rates are going towards it.
Well, what else do your rates go towards? You've got, you know, your rates are there for facilities for the future. And I think we're making a major statement about Port Erin. It's here for the long term. You know, whether you like the building or not, that's always going to be a subjective point of view. The fact I like it, you know, unfortunately I do.
Do all the commissioners like it?
Yes. Not all.
Not all?
Not all, no. But, you know...
How tough was that decision then? I mean, how close was it? Because...
No, I think if you go back to what I said earlier, first vote we had, do we keep the building? Once you've got that out of the way, then you can look at what you can do with the space, whether it's a traditional-looking one, a glass modern-looking one. You've got all sorts of options there, and you've got options about how it's laid out, whether you use the footprint of the original building, whether you work around that in a different way. But there's all sorts of other parts to the construction about how we had to raise it slightly because of the drainage to make it...
And floods and stuff like that.
Because of potential flooding.
So were the other half of the... Well, not the half, but the other side of the board who weren't... Okay, you all agreed you needed to get rid of it, but the ones who perhaps weren't supportive of this design, were they wanting something more traditional? What were they wanting?
No, I think generally...
Or just something different?
Well, an interesting point I made, once the final plans were presented to us by the architects, the architect left the room and there was silence. And we all looked at each other. And the first thing I said was, can you tell me what you don't like about it? And that was a very difficult question for a lot of them to answer because, yeah, okay, they might have been thinking, well... That's a little bit too big here. That's not what I had it totally in mind. But generally, I can't speak for them all, but I would say 75% of the board were content with the plan, whilst not hitting what they would have liked to have seen. But we can't keep going around in circles going, here's what I want and here's what I want, because you'll never get to any conclusion.
But it's interesting, the board, I've been doing a questionnaire asking boards what their most controversial decisions might be. You sort of acknowledged at a recent meeting that the Cozy Nook might be one of them. You must have known that there would be reaction, even though you're all content or you couldn't pick holes in it.
Yeah, right, okay, reaction by the public? Oh, absolutely, well... We were on hiding to nothing.
Because anything you do would be the wrong thing. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. If we'd have left it where it was, how many people would have said it's a missed opportunity? You know, look what they did at the Sound. And I know there's people out there who still want that wooden old shack back up there and some little windows that you can't see anything out of. But that was a great opportunity and it's paid dividends. It's a fantastic facility. And we would like to do something that mirrors that, something that's in it for you, not just to have a small little cafe. I don't want a monstrous thing. We don't want a massive commercial operation. We want something, though, that's a statement that's going to be there for 40 or 50 years.
And blue flag status. I noticed there are showers involved. There are other facilities to do with the beach involved. Is there any connection to that? Because I know it's something that perhaps as a tourist beach, as a destination that Port Erin might be wanting to work towards. So some of those facilities, are they linked at all?
There's going to be a little fountainy area right next to where you come
sort
up from
like
the beach.
Sort of like a wash your feet kind
of thing. For kids maybe, yeah. We've not deliberately gone along any sort of route that says, right, blue flag, and this is...
But it could help, conceivably.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, things even like toilets that are open 24 hours a day, well, we don't really need them because we've got toilets just down the road. You know, I think we can look at specifics like that where we might not have thought of the blue flag status. Well, we might have missed something there. However, the plans still haven't gone to planning yet. And if there's bits like that we think we can add on, because there are facilities maybe for putting shower unity area on the side or whatever. Mm. However, no, that wasn't a priority, I'm afraid.
When it comes to the planning application, is this it? Are you, as a board, are you committed to this planning application? And is there any way you could change your mind on that application?
Well, we're not changing our mind because that's what the board have decided to do. And why would we? And it's going in as it is. People who object to it because if they feel that there's a little bit of, I don't know, the old days going, I'm sorry for that, but we have to make a decision. And just on the bit about how popular it may or may not be, all my colleagues at work, albeit not many of them live in Port Erin itself, have commented to me that they think the designs are great. My partner was down at the hairdressers last night and she was told there that the design was great. So I think sometimes online comments may favour or be more utilised by people who are unhappy with things maybe than happy with things. So.
Port Erin Commissioner Nick Watterson. That's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon, and you can listen again to this episode online as a podcast via Spotify or the Manx Radio website. But for now, stay safe, Gurumayu, and goodbye.